This is a podcast for Tuesday, May 10th, 2011, Contemporary Moral Issues, and we're talking about feminism. So, just a bit of background in case you didn't notice, men and women are different. How are they different? Well, there are, and by the way, you can look at the PowerPoint presentation in Moodle. It should be in week 7, and download that and follow along as I speak. And bear with me, I've got some allergies, so my voice might sound a little froggy. Okay, so there are obvious differences between the sex. What are the differences we want to look at in talking about women's rights? Well, one is testosterone. Men have lots of testosterone coursing through their body, particularly when they're young. When they reach adolescence, and this is why the majority of violent crimes are committed by men, and why prisons are filled primarily with men, and that is why the majority of sexual assaults are committed by men. And so, now this doesn't mean that men necessarily have antisocial tendencies, but it doesn't mean that men have aggressive tendencies which can be channeled into antisocial activities. So anything I should say here should not be construed to say that it's okay to commit a violent crime or a sexual assault because it's natural, but men do have these naturally aggressive tendencies that women do not possess to the same degree. Now, again, these are averages, these are biological bases, which can be overridden by culture and also can be different in different individuals. So we're talking broadly and generally here. Also, men and women tend to think differently. Men tend to be better at mathematics and spatial ability. Women tend to be better at verbal and social abilities. And again, these are generalities. This doesn't mean that that women aren't good at math. It just means that women aren't as good as men in math overall, in general. I knew a math instructor at a community college I used to work at. She was much better at math than I was, and she had a much better aptitude at math than I did. I remember a friend of mine, she used to read sci-fi and fantasy novels while listening to the instructor go over calculus problems I was struggling to understand as a junior in high school. And the instructor would occasionally call on her, and she would give the correct answer, showing that she was able to simultaneously read her fantasy novel and listen to the problem, or to listen enough and look up and at a glance understand what was going on and give the correct answer. So so again, these are talking about averages and where people tend to follow, and these natural clustering of people in various skill levels. And so although you will find individuals who are outliers who defy these generalities, if you look at the vast majority of people and their tendencies, you can see these things working themselves out in society. Based on these differences, there are also psychological differences. Men tend to identify with their work and career much more so than women, and women tend to identify more with relationships, with family. Men tend to make decisions through authority structures, women through consensus. So they've done these experiments where they take a group of men and a group of women, give them the same problem to solve, and men will tend to elect a leader, decide on some rules, break the task into manageable chunks. The women will talk about the problem. People will share their ideas. There's no leader. If there are rules, they are informal in nature. And rather than voting, women make sure everyone's on board and communication and cooperation is focused on, whereas men tend to think in more authoritarian or hierarchical structures. Why might this be? Well, this comes back to the evolution of humanity when we were a hunter-gatherer society, when we were living in caves and living in grass huts. And when you have men who naturally have more upper body strength and more lean muscle mass, largely because of testosterone, you have a person who is more suited to hunting wild animals and to protecting the tribe from other tribes. And so you have the kind of a warrior archetype who's the protector, and the hunter, which is seen as masculine. And then women must give birth to children in ages before birth control. Women are pregnant quite a lot, and because they are incapacitated with serial pregnancies and not able to, you imagine going out big as a whale trying to hunt the woolly mammoth while you're pregnant. That's not practical. And so, because women are both pregnant and then nursing existing children, they stay at the camp or the cave, and they nurse their children, and they also become the de facto teachers of the tribe. And also they go out and gather roots and berries and other things to supplement the meat that the hunters bring home. And actually the staple of the Paleolithic society was roots and vegetables and berries and meat. Meat was not eaten in the vast quantities that we eat it today, because hunting's tough. So even in good hunting grounds, you can't always bring home lots of meat. So the woman's role was actually extremely important. So as women are back there at the camp with the children, teaching them what's important: verbal skills, social skills, raising up the child to learn, don't touch that poisonous snake, or here are the kinds of roots and berries that you can eat. Here are the ones that are poison that you shouldn't eat. And so verbal skills became important. And also, when you're out, think about the men. When you're out hunting, what's important there? Well, division of labor. And if you're going to catch wild animals, you need to go about it in a intentional way. And if one guy is sort of the rogue hunter and runs out there and scares the animals away, you've ruined it for everyone. You have to coordinate things, but you also have to coordinate things silently. And so when you're out there walking the woods, you can't be gabbing at the top of your lungs, because you're going to scare the animals away. And so you get the sort of archetype of the strong silent macho man. It has an evolutionary advantage or explanation. And when you think about the man's role as the provider, this goes back to their role as hunter. That can be seen as analogous to a career, whereas the women are the keepers of hearth and home, and the mothers and teachers of children. Well, you can see how these gender roles would naturally lead to women being treated as second-class citizens. Who has all the power? The men. Who has the weapons? The men. Who thinks in terms of hierarchy? The men. And so you have what's called patriarchy, or rule by men, and also a history of oppression of women, where women in many societies, and still in societies today, are treated as the property of their fathers or their husbands. And you also have, in extreme cases, examples of misogyny, of women being treated as the temptress, as the personification of evil, as the seductress who will lead a man away from the straight path and lead him into sin. And so, you'll probably you get this the get a lot of history of this if you take a sociology class or history class at LCC. So I'm not going to go into a great deal about this, but suffice it to say that the history of civilization generally has been women treated as property, or as even in the best societies, as second-class citizens. And although you can find matriarchal societies and particularly in Africa, and you find these sort of indigenous cultures who worship the powers of fertility, and women are a little better off, by and large, women have this subordinate role, because the role of protector is also the role of authority figure and decision maker. So, how have things changed in the last 150 years with the women's rights or feminist movement? Well, first you had the Industrial Revolution. So, when you think about how goods are made before factories and before assembly line productions, if you're, say, a shoemaker and you want to hire an apprentice, are you going to hire a woman? No. Why not? Because she might get knocked up. And the years that you put in instructing this person on the complex craft about how to make a comfortable, durable shoe will go out the window. You just wasted years of your life training someone who's going to go off and marry someone else and have a bunch of children. And so there were practical reasons why, again, before birth control, that having a female apprentice didn't make economic sense. And so with factory work, though, you do not need to be a highly skilled craftsman. If you're working in a shoe factory, you're just doing menial, repetitive labor. You're taking the shoes off the conveyor belt and putting them in a box, or you're putting in one little eyelet with a little handheld gizmo or a machine, or maybe you've got a machine that puts in all the eyelets for the shoelaces at one time by taking a big handle and pushing it down and then lifting it back up at the right time. Or maybe you have to load the shoe into the machine and then grab the handle, pull down, wait a minute, pull back up, and then move the shoe onto the conveyor belt and let the new, next shoe come down. So you're doing this repetitive labor in a factory. And what happens if you get pregnant? Well, you can a factory owner might have one of the women who's working for him might take care of the babies. Meanwhile, once your kid gets to be the age where he can kind of walk around, maybe 3 or 4, he can help too. He can take the shoes and put them in the box, or she. And so you have child labor. And so women and children become workers in factories because skilled labor is no longer needed. So the Industrial Revolution was a first big step in making women into workers, of getting women into the workforce. A second big step was World War II. When you had, even after World War I, still the majority of people that would say work in an office, and even as nurses would be men. So you'd have male nurses, you'd have male teachers. Although teacher, after a while the teacher role became more and more a female role, particularly in the 19th century. You would get a woman who would never marry, a woman who was, say, unattractive, or for whatever reason, not suited for marriage, and didn't marry when she was young, and thought that there was no hope of marriage later in life. Or a person who is widowed would become teachers. So you did have some women teachers, but you still had a lot of men as teachers and a lot of men as nurses and as secretaries. So if you had a secretary to take a memo, that would typically be a man. Well, during World War II, all the young men go off to fight Hitler and Tojo, and you're left with women. And women move into these roles, not just as nurses and teachers, but also traditional male roles like being a riveter in a factory again. So in between the Industrial Revolution and World War II, you have women coming out of the factories. You have as society becomes more prosperous because of all these material goods, because of increased efficiency, you have the wealth of society growing. And as the wealth of society grows, people have the attitude, both men and women, that we don't want women working in factories. And so what happens is that laws are passed against women working in factories, and there are also laws against child labor. And so and you don't need as many factory workers either after a time. And so you get fewer and fewer women working in factories. But World War II comes along, all of a sudden, who's going to make the armaments for the war? Women. And so you have Rosie the Riveter, that famous picture by J. Howard Miller. And I also included a picture of a little more butch Rosie eating a sandwich on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post, a very famous Norman Rockwell picture. And you can see she's on this kind of wooden pillar, and her feet don't quite reach to the bottom, and so she's got a copy of Mein Kampf that she's using as a footstool. And the other factor in women's liberation is contraception. So finally, a solution to the problem, oh, if I hire this woman, she'll become pregnant, and then she will have to take several months off, and then she'll have a child to take care of. And so this is before government-subsidized child care. This is before the Family Medical Leave Act, right? So this is so people think, well, mothers, once a woman becomes a mother, her primary role should be that of a child care giver. So contraception allows women to put off childbearing or totally forego it. And so you have women who more women go to college, and more women move into career paths because they're not stuck at home taking care of children. So while credit should be given to pioneers of the feminist movement like Susan B. Anthony, like Harriet Taylor, I think it's also important to recognize there are material conditions and causes which led to the changes in female gender roles, which have nothing to do with social movements or changes in socialization, but that you have social changes based on material changes, changes in the material and economic conditions of human beings. Some positive impacts of the feminist movement: women's abilities to do most things well, as well as a man, is recognized. Anything you can do, I can do better. that old song, can't recall what that's from. You have recognition of women's abilities, women being given the right to vote in the 20s in America, also women having more rights, and generally being treated as equal to a man. And so it's interesting to think about what's like someone my parents' age might feel like. Having a woman as a boss, that was seen as sort of an odd thing, and many men felt uncomfortable about it. And when I was first starting teaching, I remember I had our department chair was a woman, and I didn't think, that Linda is my boss and Linda is a woman. I feel uncomfortable about that because she's a woman in authority over me. And I didn't think about her particularly as a woman. I recognized that she was a woman, but I didn't think anything of it. Whereas that wasn't the case in times past. And in class on Tuesday, when the recording was lost, unfortunately, students shared that they didn't think there was anything strange about a man being a nurse. And there were stay-at-home dads who shared in class and thought it was great, and women whose husbands were stay-at-home dads while they went to school. And so society is changing even more, and these differences in gender roles are becoming much more blurred, and you're getting men going into more traditional helping professions, physical therapy, nursing, and even teaching, and you have more women going into traditionally male roles, and in the business world, salesmen, and particularly managers. You know, if you look at the executive team at LCC, Mary Spildy is the college's president. She's a woman, and it used to be, I think, that the vast majority of people on the leadership team at LCC are women. I think a majority still is. There have been some changes there. But the president, the vice president, and the deans are predominantly women. And that again, just a few decades ago, would have been an unusual thing. Today, the majority of women receive bachelor degrees, or more women than men receive bachelor's degrees. They receive the lion's share but the majority of bachelor's degrees and advanced degrees as well, masters and PhDs. The majority of law degrees are going to women now, and so when you see and you get more men dropping out of school, both in high school and college, and women becoming much more educated, and therefore increasing their earning power as well. Also, you have more freedom from narrowly prescribed gender roles for both men and women. A man can be a stay-at-home dad. A woman can be a career woman, and she's not thought as being less than a woman if she doesn't have children and a family. Women are allowed to take initiative in dating. Men can do the laundry and not feel as if they're being feminine when they do that. They can help out around the house. And this, you know, a lot of this comes from the fact that men of my generation and of younger generations have seen this model. They've as a little boy, you'd had to help do the dishes, fold the laundry, help out with household tasks. Why? Because mom's out there in the work world. And so when you grow up seeing your mother as a breadwinner too, it doesn't seem strange to see women in the workplace or to have a woman as a boss, because you're used to seeing your mother in that role as an employee. And similarly, if your dad stayed home with you for a time while your mother worked, then also you see your father as a kind of a caregiver, as taking a role in child care, and so it doesn't seem strange to you as a man to go into that role yourself. Also, if you're a woman, you're growing up, you're not thinking, oh, I'm going to be a mother, I'm going to be a nurse or a teacher, because those are the only roles you think. It might be that your mother's a lawyer, or maybe even an engineer. Less likely she's an engineer, but she could be a middle manager, and you could think, well, I'm going to go into the work world, I'm going to be a corporate executive, just like mom. And we'll probably talk about these things a little more on Thursday. Some objections to the feminist movement. One is that it in the past especially, has tended to denigrate women's traditional roles as mothers and homemakers. And so, as a reaction to women being relegated to one particular role of mother and homemaker, you have this strong reaction in the early feminist movement against marriage, against motherhood. And a woman who didn't have a career was looked down on by many feminists. Now there's a kind of a more moderate view towards motherhood, but there's still a kind of a stigma attached to a woman who has never held a job outside the home. Also, feminism is traditionally, because it was a reactionary or radical movement, associated with leftist, socialist, or statist economic and social policies. So, while many people would say, well, yeah, I agree that a woman should receive equal pay for equal work, and I think it's wrong to sexually harass a woman, and I think that women deserve full civil rights. Still, a person wouldn't say, I'm therefore a feminist. And it still seems strange to people to hear a man say, I'm a feminist. But when you just think about being a feminist in general, you don't generally think of, oh, well, equal pay for equal work, or women should be treated fairly, or and so on. You think of this sort of bra-burning stereotype, or Gloria Steinem, or angry man-hating lesbians. And to be fair, this has been in the history of the movement. You had people like Gloria Steinem, who said that a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. You had Betty Friedan, who wrote the Feminine Mystique and talked about how terrible it was to be relegated to being a housewife. And you also had then you have these sort of puritanical lesbians like Andrea Dworkin, and Catherine MacKinnon, who are two lesbians who they're both they're I think they're both lesbians, or at least Andrea Dworkin is, and they're for censorship policies, and they want to censor pornography. And they see, Andrea Dworkin is famously quoted as saying, "All sex is rape." So or all heterosexual sex is rape. Just because of the mechanics that sex, she says, is a woman having sex with a man is being violated. So that's a pretty extreme position. It doesn't represent kind of mainstream thinking, but that's an aspect of the feminist movement. Also, because women do still have this role as a bearer of children and those who provide childcare, you get stumping for government childcare or government subsidized childcare, so a woman can go to work and not be left with the task of childcare. So this is a way for a woman to have both a career and a family. If Uncle Sam can take care of her kids while she's at work, many feminists think this is just great. And finally, feminism tends to see gender as socially constructed and ignores the real biological differences between men and women, and tries to squeeze men into feminine roles. And so you have boys in schools being taught by female teachers and being told to sit still, to pay attention and listen. Meanwhile, those boys who have testosterone coursing through their veins want to run around outside. They want to do something with their hands. They're bored out of their gourd. Whereas many of the women, the young girls are there, and they're perfectly happy to sit at the desk or do some crafts and just or sort of listen to the teacher to read in class. And so you have this, and then when games are played, boys love competition. They love things which allow an outlet for their aggressive nature, and those things are repressed in boys. And this leads to numerous behavior problems. It leads to the drugging of boys, and things like ADD, which is a genuine problem, but it's overdiagnosed. And it's my opinion that many children who are put on psychiatric medication, sometimes at the behest of the school to solve behavior problems, those behavior problems would be better addressed just giving those boys a chance to run around and do something aggressive and competitive. There's a book by Christina Hoff Sommers which goes into detail about this called The War Against Boys. Also, there's this idea of competition is bad because if you lose self-esteem, and this worry about lawsuits, and so dodgeball is gone, and keeping score is frowned upon. And again, these are sort of feminine ideas that it's the most important thing is for everyone to get along. And so you and even there are rules against rules against playing cops and robbers or cowboys and Indians, as children used to do. Using your finger as a gun and going bang bang is seen as a terrorist threat. And so you get these kind of zero tolerance policies against violence, and it means that a kid can't bring, say, a toy, can't play with a toy gun, or even use his finger as a gun, or you don't play war, or you don't play cops and robbers. And these are things that young boys naturally like to do. What's a sort of a natural game for women to play? Well, playing house, playing with dolls. This reminds me of a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon where Calvin and I think Susie are they're playing house, and Calvin's doing a face palm. He's got his palm planted in his forehead and says, "I don't know how we're gonna pay the mortgage this month." So there's the modern version of playing house. In class, we talked about how there are still vestiges of sexism in our society. Women are not required to sign up for selective service so that they may be drafted. Women are still kept out of combat roles, although moving into combat roles more. And again, there are these physical differences. So there's this question about, do you want to socially engineer the army and have a woman in a role where maybe she's not physically able to do it? Are you going to water down the physical standards in order to allow women into those positions? And then what happens when your troop has to make a 20-mile quick march, and the woman can't keep up because she doesn't have the strength to carry the 100-pound pack, or she doesn't have the strength to lift up her buddy who's just been shot and carry him like a sack of potatoes, over the hill? Or, and you can think about this in terms of women as firefighters and other jobs. So there's this debate about whether or not to allow equality, whether you need to water down the physical standards, which men can meet, but women have more difficulty meeting. I should mention too that even someone like Ayn Rand, who is a kind of a type A personality, and I'd say a very archetypical male personality, very aggressive, very self-sufficient, very strong, forceful person. And so as a particularly as a woman, but just as a human being, she was had a lot of male characteristics. And she had a philosophy of individualism. But still, even Ayn Rand thought that a woman would not make a good president. And her ideal of love was of a woman find a man who is worthy of her admiration, and a man find a woman who is worthy of his possession. And so even Ayn Rand has this sort of traditional view of gender roles, of the man as the primary and the woman as the secondary. And even I had a colleague who shall remain nameless say that she didn't think a woman would make a good president. So I'd say it's not just men who can be sexist, even sexist against their own sex. And there are also cases that if you're dealing with, say, a custody dispute, there's a strong supposition that the woman ought to be the default guardian of children. And it's changing to some extent, but typically women are awarded custody of the children, and there's a bias in our judicial system against men getting full custody of children if there's a dispute, if the parents say they have to live in different places, that someone has to relocate because of a job or what have you, and there's a custody dispute. The question about who gets primary custody, there is a tendency to give that to the woman. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about feminism on Thursday and move right into discussing affirmative action. And so make sure to read that you've read those two readings in Satris. And also there are some handouts in Moodle in week 7. And we'll probably only get up to the Rethinking Diversity readings. So look at the Satris readings, and look at we might get into the diversity readings a little bit, maybe that first one by yours truly, Rethinking Diversity, but we probably won't get through all of them. Also a reminder about the test is currently open, and I'm giving everyone until next Tuesday to take it, so I've moved up one more day. Tuesday is the absolute last day to take the second exam, because we've got to squeeze in two more exams before the end of the term. So Tuesday, close of Tuesday, 7 p.m., arrive by 6, you get a note card front and back to take the exam. And good luck. And if you have any questions, I sent out a couple of announcements. You might want to check those. There's a practice test on Moodle. There was a supplementary podcast I put up. Although you can listen to that. It covers some of the same material. And actually, in class on this previous recording, also covers. Which you've probably already listened to, but that's all also covers the material on the study guide as well. So make sure you've looked at the capitalism and socialism handouts, the questions in the announcements section on price gouging, and taking the practice test. You can take the test as many times as you like till you get 100%, and some of those questions may be on the actual exam. Okay, that's it for now, and you'll hear from me again on Thursday.